The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Gia Kokotakis with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for July 22, 2023. This week, the New York Times released an article detailing how Trump and his allies plan to restructure and expand presidential power in 2025 should the former president be elected again. For today's Archive episode, I picked an episode from November 18, 2020, in which Benjamin Wittes sat down with Susan Hennessy, Scott R. Anderson, and Rudy Marboni to discuss Trump's expansion of his influence and executive power at the end of his administration, including his installment of loyalists and an executive order making it easier for the executive branch to hire and fire people in agencies.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 18th, 2020. The president, in the waning days of his administration, has attempted to install a political loyalist as general counsel of the National Security Agency, a position that is traditionally a merits position, not a political position. He has also issued an executive order that gives the executive branch greater control over the civil service, making it easier to hire and fire people in agencies. It all raises the question, is Donald Trump attempting to create the very deep state that he has spent the last 4 years denouncing? To talk over this question in its various permutations, we got together in the virtual jungle studio Susan Hennessy, whose recent article about the NSA general counsel appointment has been getting a lot of attention, Scott Anderson, Lawfare senior editor, and Rudy Marboni, senior advisor at Democracy Fund Voice, senior fellow at the Brennan Center, and former director of the Office of Presidential Personnel, an associate counsel to the president in the Obama White House. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 18th. Is Trump creating a deep state? Scott, get us started with an overview here. It seems to me that the president has issued an executive order that has a lot of people concerned, that implicates some civil service issues. He has also attempted to install somebody who is not obviously qualified for the position as general counsel at NSA, which raises certain similar set of issues. Give us an overview of the personnel concerns that give rise to this conversation.
Well, really, over the last couple of weeks, we have seen this kind of escalation of different sorts of personnel activities on the part of the Trump administration. Prior to the election, we saw the issuance of this executive order that you mentioned, which essentially creates a new category of employee in what's called the accepted service, which is that universe of federal employees that aren't subject to the same normal restrictions on removal and other sorts of tenure type arrangements that'll ensure their job stability and security, including against a potential sort of either patronage appointments or politically motivated appointments and removals. It helps insulate against that. We've also seen a number of removals and appointments since the election, a number of high-level removals from the Defense Department that's gotten a lot of attention. We've discussed previously on the podcast and a few other agencies, including USAID, National Nuclear Security Administration, and also this appointment of someone, Michael Ellis, from previous at the National Security Council and other parts in government, seen as a Trump loyalist in at the National Security Agency, in a kind of maybe not unique, but relatively unusual sort of career arrangement there that we can get more into. I know Susan has written on to elaborate. Really, the takeaway picture, though, is that this is kind of the culmination of a little bit of a campaign that's always been part of the Trump administration's rhetoric and that they've taken steps towards in the past. And that is this idea of reforming the civil service. The Trump administration has always viewed government service and government employees as, in the worst light, as a deep state, as a kind of independent cohort of individuals who have their own political views that happen to be contrary to the president's at different times were seen as actively working to undermine him. And even when they weren't actively part of the kind of deep state conspiracy side of the equation, they often bought into and kind of echoed longstanding criticisms of the civil service, saying that federal employees are too hard to remove, they're not held accountable enough, and there needs to be ways to fix that. And riding along that line, we've seen them take a number of personnel actions, not just these most recent ones, but even a few years back, you know, installing greater executive control over the appointment of administrative law judges, more recently changing policies around how you try and educate federal employees around diversity issues, different sorts of training programs. And there really is this sort of effort to change the shape and the face of the civil service as it stands, and perhaps to make that more of an enduring legacy of the Trump administration as it prepares to leave office.
So Trump has long, as you say, complained of a deep state. But number one, if you strengthen the executive control over the civil service right now, you're not actually advantaging Donald Trump against the deep state. You're advantaging Joe Biden and his ability to control things. Moreover, some of the steps that they've taken recently seem to me a little bit more like efforts to create a deep state that is a kind of burrowing in of loyalists in career positions than it is a effort to strengthen executive control over the civil service. So, Rudy, help me out here. What is the broad concern that you have as you watch the Trump administration's conduct with respect to the civil service over the last few months?
Well, look, I think that you highlight something that has been a concern even before the most recent executive order was adopted. And this pertains to Donald Trump trying to undermine the ability of the executive branch agencies to function based upon their expertise and professionalism, even in a future Biden administration. And I think that the executive order is causing significant concern, in part because of the unknown questions surrounding it. So as you might know, Ben, this concern around burrowing is one that arises toward the end of almost every administration. And because of it, Congress has actually required the Office of Personnel Management, which is the primary HR agency, essentially, for the federal government, to conduct a review of conversions that take place or movements from a political position into a career competitive position to ensure that those individuals are qualified and to make a report available to Congress of any such conversions that take place. It's notable to mention that the most recent report, at least last that I checked on it, had still not been made available to Congress. And part of the concern here is that you will have specific actors who are working to thwart the intentions of a future administration. I think it's also notable that the actions that are being taken right now, possibly under this new executive order toward the civil service, they are another step in the ways the current administration has attacked personnel, even when it comes to political appointees and the political appointments process throughout the administration. I mean, I know that you have talked about this with other guests on your podcast, and it has been written about ad nauseum of the ways that the Trump administration has abused federal laws that pertain to the designation and appointment of acting officials under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, his insistence and refusal to appoint and nominate permanent officials to vacant positions, and in other tactics that we've seen from his presidential personnel office and the current director of the presidential personnel office to essentially root out any political appointee, regardless of how they have performed, if they are not seen as sufficiently loyal to the Trump administration. So the concerns are significant and will have to be grappled with if this current executive order is implemented in the way that is of most concern to the experts that have looked at it.
All right, let's talk about the executive order in a moment. But first, I want to talk about the burrowing effect. Susan, the office in which you served for several years appears to now be the province of Michael Ellis, who got out of law school a year or two before you did, and has spent the subsequent time working for Congressman Nunes and for the National Security Council. So first of all, I want to ask you, are you qualified to run the Office of General Counsel at NSA? And is Michael Ellis any more qualified for that position than you are?
You know, I will reserve for the moment the question of whether or not I possess such extraordinary qualifications as to be ready to serve in that role at my obviously very young age. You know, look, the question about Ellis is not just one of sort of his lack of qualifications. It's really his lack of qualifications compared to the other two individuals reportedly who were considered in the process, Brad Brooker and Tisha Anthony, both highly respected, long-serving attorneys in the intelligence community who are manifestly more qualified and are manifestly more qualified than me, certainly. And that raises eyebrows because it appears that a process that is designed to avoid political interference has somewhat perplexingly selected the candidate who objectively has the least amount of experience. And also that the process, there are indications of a lot of irregularities that suggest that actually that process didn't function in the manner that it was supposed to. So Rudy mentioned that one sort of feature of these senior executive roles is OPM has oversight, right, in order to sort of prevent this phenomenon of burrowing or improper conversion. The NSA general counsel position falls in a little bit of a different category of regulations, and that's basically that for senior executive career officials in the Defense Department and the intelligence community, they don't want to have to go through OPM review, right? There are sort of specific national security sensitivities, difficulty in being able to share particular types of information related to background or qualifications. And so there is basically the ability in Title 10 for the Secretary of Defense to create kind of his own category of accepted service, but it's supposed to look like the category that we've been talking about, the sort of ordinary OPM, you know, federal bureaucracy SES service. And so this process by which Ellis has been selected, it's really, really difficult to understand precisely all the applicable regulations and rules because the Defense Department is just a very difficult, non-transparent organization in this sense. But we can say that reports in both the New York Times and the Washington Post, the White House picked up the phone and called the Defense Department to pressure the DOD General Counsel and potentially the selection board into either including putting Ellis on the list in the first place, or that he was their preferred candidate and actually picking him. That's not supposed to happen. That's against the rules. And it's especially important that we want the rules to be observed with jobs like this, and this job in particular, because the NSA General Counsel's job is one that it sort of, it lives right on the edge, right? So whatever we think about sort of political accountability, we want the cabinet level to be politically responsive to the White House, confirmed with advice and consent of the Senate. We want political appointees to be responsive to the policy priorities of the White House. And we want this career senior executive service. And the NSA General Counsel is one that could kind of go either way. There are really good arguments on either side why we really want this to be in the sort of the senior executive service, because we don't want political considerations. We don't want political considerations in hiring. We don't want political considerations in the way that the individual discharges the essential functions of the office. We want to prevent the kind of turnover that might happen every 4 or 8 years or even on a shorter timeline that's sort of typical of political appointments. That said, it's a really important position. I mean, it's a position that plays an important policy role. And it's a position that there's good arguments that it does require the type of oversight that comes with the advice and consent of the Senate and requiring it that it be a confirmed position. And the real fear right now is that the Trump administration is sort of capitalizing on a loophole. The NSA General Counsel's position is both not Senate confirmed, and they are also potentially sort of distorting or circumventing the apolitical merit selection process in order to sort of entrench this person, either to give him a job in the long term, right? These are people who are going to be out of work as of January 20th at noon. The Trump administration officials might have a more difficult time finding private sector work than the prior administration staffers have. And two, and even more alarmingly, you know, that it might be borrowing as an attempt to sort of entrench a particular ideological viewpoint, or entrench an individual in a position who might have loyalties to particular parties on Capitol Hill, might serve as sort of a back channel. And that's whenever we get to sort of the types of borrowing that isn't just about violations of ethics rules, but actually really, really corrupt the ability of agencies to function, the ability of the civil service to function in ways that are pretty corrosive and alarming.
All right. So let's talk about the executive order. Scott, to what extent does the executive order raise the same set of concerns? And to what extent does it raise the reciprocal set of concerns, which is too much executive control over the civil service?
It really does both. It has both a removal concern and a borrowing concern.
So let's walk through that. What precisely does it do, and how can it raise both concerns at the same time?
So essentially, what the executive order does is it directs each agency head to review a whole list of positions within their agency for consideration as to whether they are of a policy advocating or a policy making sort of role. There's a specific key set of language there, which is language that's cued to certain statutory authorities the president has to say, well, if these positions are of a policy advocating or policy making type, confidential type positions, then I can make them part of the accepted service, not part of the usual competitive service, which lowers certain types of protections, limits, provides more flexibility in hiring, to some degree, more flexibility in removal. And that's usually done for various certain types of specialized positions, and most notably what are often called Schedule C off of another schedule in this accepted service positions, which are kind of lower ranking political appointment positions that are, I think, the majority probably of political appointed positions. I'm actually not sure exactly where the ratio breaks down, but most of the kind of special assistant type, senior advisor type positions are likely to be Schedule C positions. This would create a new list called Schedule F, which they describe, the executive order describes, as positions that are of this policy-making, policy-advocating, confidential character, but that do not usually transition or do not usually change hands during a political transition or presidential transition, distinguishing them from Schedule C, where they do usually transition. They are expressly and intended to be political appointee positions. What this does is by categorizing these positions with this particular label, this policy advocating label, it triggers a number of statutory hooks that basically say, okay, usually when you're removing a federal employee, there's a probationary period, there's a certain process you have to go through to remove them, to punish them, to take any sorts of actions. That is waived now for this particular type of position, bringing a lot more freedom. There's another provision that lays out certain types of prohibited personnel practices, of which many of them may be are waived by this sort of statutory invocation of this hook. Although it's worth noting, the executive order actually says this broad list still should apply to people on Schedule F, but it's going to do so through some new regulatory process that has to be developed. It's not going to be necessarily straightforward through the statutory action. It's a little bit ambiguous there, but that appears to be, at least from an OPM guidance letter that came later, how they're interpreting it. So it provides some more freedom once you transition these positions to allow the president to certainly appoint people more easily, fill the positions in a similar manner as political appointments. And then it might provide some degree to remove them. It certainly does on paper. In practice, though, especially if they're serious about leaving in some of these prohibited personnel practices, I think if you talk to various people, they're not 100% sure how much it lowers the bar for removal for people who are actually in that Schedule F position, because there are still going to be a variety of ways that they can challenge that removal on the basis of those prohibited personnel practices once that process is in place, if it's implemented kind of in good faith. But that's something we're waiting to see. The removal concern really comes in with, well, these are all existing positions, many of which, most of which, if not all of which, have people in them currently. So what happens to those people when they convert from a career position to the Schedule F position? And I don't think there's real clear game plan for that. We haven't had the White House come out and tell us, here's what we're going to do. The executive order doesn't say it either. It's a possibility that all those people will be provided the opportunity to stay in their role and just kind of re-sign as a Schedule F person as opposed to a career person. But that does mean giving up certain types of job protections. And certainly the kind of more conventional model of civil service job protections that's available. Or it could be that the administration intends to essentially say, nope, all you guys, your position just went away, the same way as if Congress cut the budget and we had to cut positions. In which case, all those people would have certain entitlements to preference in rehiring, opportunities to bid for other jobs in their sort of agency. But in effect, especially if it affects a lot of people at once, it at a minimum is going to create a lot of chaos, a lot of heartache for people in those positions, especially again, if they're not provided the opportunity to stay in their jobs and just convert to Schedule F. Many of them may choose to convert to Schedule F for that reason, although it may not be the choice that they would ideally pursue otherwise. Once you're in Schedule F, there's this question as to, well, can this be used to facilitate burrowing in? Because essentially what it says is, okay, we're going to allow the president to appoint people with a lot more flexibility and put them in these positions. But these positions, as a matter of the descriptor, are not intended to change over as a strictly political type position. And again, they are still protected by these prohibited personnel practices, which includes removing people for strictly their political views. So that could, in theory, mean that if the Trump administration moves forward and fills a bunch of these new Schedule F positions with loyalists for them, it could be difficult, or at least be cumbersome, for the Biden administration to really effectively remove them. Although it may just be a matter of time and effort, as opposed to just making it categorically impossible. They would essentially have to, first, if the Trump administration doesn't develop a process for actually doing so, again, that's left open in the executive order, and then say, okay, here's the kind of administrative case for why these people aren't qualified for this position or otherwise aren't appropriately suited. And we're going to go through this process of removing them, but make clear that we're not discriminating against them for their political views or anything like that, that would be subject to maybe these prohibited personnel practices. Again, that could cause a problem. Like, there may be, it seems like there could be or should be a ways for the administration to do that, but it's just going to take time and a lot of work, both to set up the process and then implement it. And it's just a lot of political risk involved. It's going to look, or at least has the potential to look, like a sort of political witch hunt, which the enemies of the Biden administration, or, you know, ex-Trump administration people, are going to be able to have a field day and say, look, they're doing exactly what they criticize us doing. They're ripping out all these people and removing them summarily. It could lead to litigation and legal challenges. That just has the potential to be a headache to be coming in. And so that's how this ends up being that double-edged sword. The one thing I'll say that I think is worth bearing in mind is, you know, not only does being moved to Schedule F or people being put Schedule F, it doesn't necessarily, at least on the face of the executive order, remove all of the sort of protections, again, because there are still these prohibited personnel practices that apply, although we don't know exactly how. There's also still constitutional protections for these people. The language that is linked to these different statutory waivers, this policymaking language or descriptor, actually comes from the Supreme Court. And specifically from a line of Supreme Court cases, going back to, I think, Ellery Rod V. Byrd, I think was the first one, which basically establishes First Amendment protections for civil servants. And they say essentially, well, people who are in these sort of policy advocating, policy making, confidential positions, which are usually means political appointees with a fairly high degree of discretion, whose job it is to reflect the views of the political principle and implement them, they can be removed for virtue of their beliefs, because that's the whole point of having political appointees. You have to have people in some of these roles that can channel the beliefs of the elected political official. But other civil servants who aren't in that sort of role, they're the protected ones. And just because the president changes that descriptor in terms of the statutory hook doesn't mean that he's actually aligning those people properly with the First Amendment jurisprudence and the case law around those sorts of First Amendment protections, meaning that somebody who is put in a Schedule F position and is then removed for different political views, even if they make a case on the administrative record, or perhaps they amend the executive order to say, oh, well, the political views prohibited personnel protection doesn't really apply here, they may still have First Amendment protections and say, no, the Supreme Court, when it used this descriptor, it meant something with a lot more discretion and authority, much closer to the political appointee and the political principle. Not me. I'm just a civil servant, and I should still have my First Amendment rights. And so it could be opening up a whole door to an array of legal challenges separate and apart from how they decide to implement and kind of emulate the whatever parts of the previous legal protections that are usually in place for federal employees.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others. And it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers, with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20. All right, Rudy, when you look at this executive order, how much progress has there been, positive or negative, in implementing it since it came down? What prevents, in other words, Joe Biden from coming in 64 days from now and simply rescinding it and making the whole thing go away?
So let me just say quick, Ben, in response, just because I think that Scott provided some reassurance to those who are concerned that they will be impacted by this executive order, that there are some legal remedies available to them. That said, I do not think you can underestimate the impact that this executive order is having on the morale and the concerns of career civil servants who could be impacted by it. I mean, you're talking about, you know, I was the general counsel of a small agency. I worked at another cabinet level agency. And if we were to move career officials from one office to another, I mean, that's probably a bad example since we're in the midst of a pandemic and everyone's working from home. But if you were to change someone's portfolio or discuss changing someone's portfolio, that would cause significant issues and concerns. So you can imagine that when you're talking about removing someone's rights and removal rights potentially are weakening them, the kind of anxieties and consequences that could result from that. But to answer your specific question, thus far, I do not think we have seen explicit public progress on implementing the executive order in a way that is creating a lot of heartburn and concern, as Scott so well outlined, by those of us who are paying close attention to personnel issues within the federal government. There is an expectation that rules would have to be promulgated to implement the executive order and to begin converting positions to Schedule F. There are some folks who are hearing from unnamed sources within government that the Trump administration might try to move forward without those rules being promulgated. I think that would be difficult, if not impossible. You know, it actually might be the case that this executive order was adopted in the hopes of being implemented in a second term rather than being implemented solely to sabotage the Biden administration. Now, to the other part of your question about what could be done to roll this back, I think that depends on how far the Trump administration gets in actually implementing the order. If they are successful in converting some positions and then hiring new people into those positions in the Schedule F, then I don't think that a President Biden could come in and with one fell swoop sign an executive order that simply rescinds President Trump's executive order, because you will now have a new class of employees who will be entitled to certain rights and privileges that you'll need to deal with. So you will likely need some legislation to handle those employees. And there is, it's worth saying, there is some legislation that is pending in the House right now that would prohibit the president from using any appropriated dollars toward the creation of Schedule F positions. You know, if the Trump administration moves forward with burrowing by putting political appointees into Schedule F positions, then I do think, as Scott outlined, this will be a headache for the Biden team. It could result in litigation by any of those Schedule F appointees who try to make a claim that their removal is not justified. And that litigation, as you and probably a substantial number of your listeners know, does not move swiftly. And so this could be a pretty significant obstacle.
Susan, to what extent is the Michael Ellis issue and the Schedule F / executive order the same issue? To what extent are they different?
Yeah, so they are the same issue when we think about sort of the animating values that underlie these various systems and designations. And they're the same issue when we talk about or think about sort of the core of the issue that President-elect Biden faces when he assumes office, which is both that he has to remediate a lot of this stuff, root out people who were burrowed, depoliticize positions that became politicized. So he has sort of that restoration project. And at the same time, he has to restore civil service protections, right? And sort of, and the norms that are designed to offer protections to people who are in various positions that are designated as not political positions. And there's a tension there, you know, that Scott sort of referenced it earlier, but right, sort of communicating to the public, this is not the same thing as what we saw during the Trump administration. This is not Biden coming in and saying anybody who ever served at a political level or is a Republican or has any ties to Trump is sort of, or was hired in the past 4 years, is rooted out. We don't want that to happen, right? That's sort of a further erosion of norms, not a restoration of norms. So whenever we think about it that way, the sort of the same issue is there. And whenever we think about kind of the bigger questions of as well of how should we expect Biden to approach things like compliance with the Vacancies Act? If we end up with a Republican control of the Senate and they take a very, very obstructionist approach to confirming the cabinet of Biden's choosing, you know, if you know, might Biden decide to employ some of the tricks that Donald Trump has shown he can get away with, even though it's not in keeping with, at a minimum, the spirit of the Constitution and relevant statutes. So there's a lot that's similar. That said, they actually have nothing to do with one another. So one, as both Scott and Rudy mentioned, the actual sort of regulations have not gone into effect. So we're in this period of sort of studying designation and review. So there's nobody who's in sort of a Schedule F position yet that we know of. Furthermore, because the position that ordinarily governs the role that Ellis is in and sort of sit or might be sworn into in the near future, is this sort of Defense Intelligence Senior Executive Service. As I mentioned earlier, those are a different set of regulations that are created under a different title of the U.S. Code. In one hand, the short answer is they've got nothing to do with each other because Schedule F explicitly applies only to positions created under Title V, and that's not what we're talking about here. That said, this category of defense and intelligence positions, both the DISIS and the DISOL, there's all these sort of various sort of alphabet soup of designations that we can think of. In all of those regulations, the Secretary of Defense is instructed to adopt regulations that are substantially equal to or conform with the OPM designations. And so if we imagine sort of this Schedule F regulation actually taking effect, positions being redesignated, and OPM altering its guidance, what we might see is that the series of essentially DOD regulations that govern this position and other similar positions will change, either because the regulations will be updated in order to conform, or because a lot of these regulations actually just directly point to OPM guidance. So even though they aren't technically governed by OPM, they say, hey, you know, here's the qualification standards for the SES. They're the same as set by OPM and X guidance. And so anything that explicitly references back and adopts the OPM standards, that'll be altered. That said, in terms of the immediate candidacy of Ellis, they basically just aren't related.
And if Joe Biden comes in and wants to get rid of Michael Ellis, what are his options?
Yeah, so there are a few. And this applies not just to Ellis, but sort of to all individuals that occupy this sort of problematic category, where they are technically in office. In office is designed to be career offices, but there are real and reasonable reasons to believe that either they were appointed in contravention of the regulations, of borrowing prevention laws, or for improper political purposes, that there's reason to sort of be suspicious about the integrity of the merits qualification process. So one thing you can do is come in and just fire everybody. And you say, okay, we're going to give you your procedural protections, which they vary, but they're things like 30 days written notice, the ability to be represented by counsel. In a lot of cases, there's like a 120-day moratorium where you aren't allowed to fire people right after a new administration takes office or a cabinet secretary or sort of a head of the department is changed. To sort of prevent this kind of house cleaning. You say, okay, we are going to fire you. One of your sort of remedies and rights is that you can go to this thing called the Merit Service Protection Board, yes? And you can argue your case. And if they determine that you actually were properly put in this position and thus you were improperly removed, then you can be reinstated as your remedy and sort of, take your luck and we'll let the Merit Service Protection Board sort it out for us. So that's kind of one option. It comes with a lot of efficiency, the danger of being over-inclusive, and a little bit of sort of optics concerns, but wouldn't be sort of absurd or out of the realm of possibilities. The other thing that Biden might do is to take a more sort of specific investigation-based approach. So ask the inspectors general of the NSA or DOD to specifically investigate the selection process at issue here and other similar processes. So today, the minority ranking members of the SSCI and the SASC, the Senate Armed Services Committee, both sent a letter to the inspector general of the Department of Defense asking them to do exactly this. I'm saying, hey, we don't think the rules were followed or we have some suspicions. Explain to us what the rules are. Resolve these sort of reports of irregularities for us, and sort of answer these specific questions. And oh, by the way, we don't think anybody should be sworn into office while these investigations are pending. And then if there is a finding, that there is irregularities in the process, you can fire someone. You can reassign them. So while there are usually protections, civil service protections against outright removal, the ability to reassign someone is pretty discretionary, pretty close to limitless. You can move someone to any similarly designated position. This happens a lot, both for sort of ordinary reasons. So some agency directors or cabinet secretaries have a really strong preference for mandatory rotation and periodic rotation. They like to see their senior executive service, sort of do different tours in different parts of the agency, to prevent groupthink and sort of allow that kind of exchange and development of expertise and ideas. You know, it's also sort of a long tradition of essentially using this to maroon people who are entitled to civil service protections, but aren't very good at their jobs or otherwise problematic, assign them to a position that they don't want to do and doesn't have a lot of substantive authority, and then let them decide to quit the government on their own. So we saw the Trump administration sort of use that tactic. It's an oldie but goodie and sort of a familiar one. Again, can come with a little bit of an optics issue, but as sort of a legal question. There's very little that any individual or sort of a career protected individual can do to stop it. And, you know, we want the federal government to have that kind of flexibility. The other thing we might see related to this specific position is, you know, there's sort of this perennial fight with the Hill where Congress always talks about, hey, this job in particular, we know that you say it shouldn't be politicized and it needs to be this career role. We don't really buy it. It's an important administrative position, certainly sort of post-Snowden revelations, the ability for Congress to exercise really a sort of muscular oversight of this office in particular. We see how important that is. And so they, you know, every few years and kind of every 3 or 4 years, there's these new proposals that come in the IAA or the NDAA saying, hey, we're going to make the then as a general counsel Senate confirmed. And the executive branch says, no. One thing we might see is Congress saying, okay, this time we really mean it. Because the thing we were afraid of all along that you promised us wouldn't happen has happened now. And so we now have a demonstration that the civil service protections are not, in fact, robust enough to prevent the kind of politicization that we're seeing here. And the only appropriate remedy here is to pass legislation and require and sort of elevate this and require it to become a Senate confirmed position, potentially as a sort of part of NSA and Cyber Command separating other status changes that might occur with the NSA. You know, that's a development that would come with some benefits, but also some real risks, right? These concerns about making roles, sort of that you want to distance from political pressure, making them political roles, you know, those carry costs. They are real costs. And so one of the challenges for the Biden administration is, how much are they thinking about sort of president-proofing the executive branch, to use sort of a nonsensical term, right? How much do they want to use their time in office to prevent the ability of future presidents to abuse the powers of the office in the way that Trump did? Something that will require the Biden administration to agree along with Congress to self-constrain, to not sort of fully assert its own institutional prerogatives and branch prerogatives, but instead, right, just sort of make common cause with Congress in order to restrain the executive as an institution? Or instead, is it going to go back to sort of the way things were before and sort of assert those really, traditional executive branch positions, in part because they want to be able to capitalize on this flexibility? I think that's going to be sort of the paradox at the core of a lot of this. And one hint that we can see in the coming days is, one, how does the Biden transition respond to developments like the announcement regarding Ellis? Do they issue statements? What is the tone and substance of those statements? And also personnel decisions. Who are they hiring and sort of indicating they're thinking about for really important senior roles? You know, personnel is policy. And that's one place that I think we're going to see a little bit of a hint of what kind of path they might be thinking moving forward.
So, Scott, if you are the Biden transition, do you look with fear on this executive order, or do you say, hey, at the end of the day, these guys are not going to get their act together to do a lot under it, so it will strengthen our hand, not theirs?
Well, you know, I really think at this point, the Biden administration needs to be, certainly in regards to the Schedule F executive order, kind of vigilant, but still waiting to see where it develops. There are a lot of questions about how and if it's going to be pursued. Again, we don't know what scale it's going to be implemented at. We don't yet have examples of what agencies, how agencies are going to implement some of these provisions. And I think you can kind of tell that that's happening because so far we actually haven't seen that much legal challenges against it. We've only seen one lawsuit that I'm aware of by a National Treasury Employees Union challenging the actual executive order itself, but kind of on the grounds that the president acted ultra vires in using some of these statutory authorities in a way that would require a court to interpret those authorities somewhat narrowly. I think it's probably a bit of an uphill battle on their statutory arguments. But even though everybody sees these big potential negative consequences, nobody's quite jumped into the fray yet to say, okay, well, we're going to start legally challenging them because we just don't know how they're going to be implemented. Judging from how effectively the Biden administration has prepared itself for a whole wave of post-election, I should say the Biden campaign, the whole wave of post-election litigation, they've got huge teams of lawyers with a lot of experience and a lot of people who are relatively recently in government themselves. I suspect that they are probably beginning to pull people together and begin looking at this to say, how big a problem is this going to be, and anticipating sorts of responses and perhaps contingencies. But, you know, I'm not even sure we really have enough of an idea of how the Trump administration is going to approach certainly the Schedule F issue to actually say, here's 100% are going to be our strategy moving forward. So they're just going to have to be in a little bit of a wait and see posture while gathering the resources, getting things together, and preparing to move relatively quickly. The one thing they are going to have to do, and I imagine that, again, with the number of former government employees that are working for the Biden administration, Biden transition, is to provide quickly, if something does happen, a clear signal to both current federal employees and those who may be individually affected by some of these personnel actions that the Biden administration has their back, that they care about the independence and the durability of the civil service, that even though I think everyone agrees that there are reforms that aren't maybe warranted in different parts of the civil service, that the core ethic of having an independent and politically neutral civil service remains important, and that the Biden administration is committed to strengthening that norm and restoring it to the extent it's damaged by the Trump administration on its way out of office. So hopefully that messaging is getting ready. The question then just remains, you know, how are we actually going to do that and accomplish that? And that's going to depend on what exactly the Trump administration does.
Yeah. So add this to a long list of issues that the Biden team is going to need to be focused on when they begin governing on day one. It is very much the case that personnel is policy, as Susan referenced, and I know that that's an overused statement, but it's a good one, and it is true. In addition to monitoring the implementation of the Schedule F executive order, remember, they have a lot of other personnel issues to have to grapple with, right? There are the vacancies, not just at the political level, but also at the career level throughout the federal government in a variety of key offices that are going to be playing important roles in furthering a Biden agenda, whether it's at the State Department, EPA, HHS, Interior, you know, you name it, they're going to need to focus on rebuilding the personnel within some of those agencies. Typically in a transition, you have the outgoing administration working hand in glove with the incoming administration on identifying the acting officials who may need to serve for a period of time while Biden's nominees are evaluated and confirmed by the Senate. Sometimes you have political appointees from the outgoing administration holding over into the incoming administration when they occupy certain key roles, particularly those that have to do with national security responsibilities. I'm not sure any of that is going to happen, frankly, right now. You also, as folks remember, have some issues around some key roles that impact accountability and oversight within the executive branch. There are a number of IG, Inspector General positions, where you have nominees pending before the Senate. One of them is a Nunes staffer, Congressman Nunes. One of his staffers has been nominated to be the new Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. And one of the things that Vice President Biden, President-elect Biden, has said repeatedly is that he wants to shore up trust in government. He wants to defend expertise and processes that allow career officials, experts, scientists, researchers to contribute to federal policy. And in order to do that, these are all the kinds of issues that he's going to need to address and his people are going to need to prioritize. And I have faith and trust that they will prioritize it. By any measure, they are preparing to have more people appointed on day one than any transition and administration, at least in modern history, because they recognize the scope of the problem. While past administrations have not wanted to expend political capital on personnel issues like this, I am hopeful that President Biden will be willing to do that. And in prioritizing personnel, I think that you will hopefully see them also prioritizing the rule of law, accountability, and transparency issues that have energized Democrats and good government officials these past 4 years, because I think that the interests that are furthered by having good personnel processes and people in place are not dissimilar from the same interests that are furthered by those rule of law reforms. So I am fully anticipating that they focus and grapple with these issues, even if it's going to present a significant challenge for them.
We're going to leave it there. Susan Hennessy, Scott Anderson, Rudy Merbani, thank you all so much for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our merch is available at the Lawfare store, and you should promote us on Twitter, on Facebook, on whatever social media you use. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.